Chapter 10. The Luck of the Irish. Our lives increasingly were being defined by work. Work at the newspapers, work on the house, work trying to get pregnant, and, nearly a full-time vocation in itself, work raising Marley. We hadn't even reached our second wedding anniversary, and already we were feeling the grind of responsible, grown-up, married life. We needed to get away. We needed a vacation, just the two of us. I surprised Jenny one evening with two tickets to Ireland. We would be gone for 3 weeks. There would be no itineraries, no guided tours, no must-see destinations. Only a rental car, a road map, and a guide to bed and breakfast inns along the way. Just having the tickets in hand lifted a yoke from our shoulders. First, we had a few duties to dole out, and at the top of the list was Marley. We quickly ruled out a boarding kennel. He was too young, too wired, too rambunctious to be cooped up in a pen 23 hours a day. As Dr. J had predicted, neutering had not diminished Marley's exuberance one bit. We made a list of every friend, neighbor, and co-worker we could think of, then one by one crossed off names. Eventually, we were left with just one. Kathy worked in my office and was single and unattached. She grew up in the rural Midwest, loved animals, and longed to someday trade in her small apartment for a house with a yard. Best of all, she said yes. Ireland was everything we dreamed it would be, beautiful, bucolic, lazy. We simply wandered, bumping our way along the coast. All of our duties and obligations back home were just distant memories. As evening approached each day, we would begin looking for a place to spend the night. Invariably, these were rooms in private homes run by sweet Irish widows who doted on us, served us tea, turned down our sheets, and always seemed to ask us the same questions. "So, would you two be planning to start a family soon?" Jenny and I became convinced there was a national law in Ireland that required all guest beds to face a large, wall-mounted likeness of either the Pope or the Virgin Mary. Some places provided both. The Irish celibate traveler law also dictated that all guest beds be extremely creaky, sounding a rousing alarm every time one of its occupants so much as rolled over. Suddenly, sex seemed so illicit. To risk sex in these surroundings was to risk shameful humiliation at the communal breakfast table the next morning. It was to risk Mrs. O'Flaherty's raised eyebrow as she served up eggs and fried tomatoes, asking with a leering grin, "So, was the bed comfortable for you too?" Ireland was a coast-to-coast no-sex zone, and that was all the invitation I needed. We spent the trip bopping like bunnies. Still, Jenny couldn't stop fretting about her big baby back home. Every few days, she would feed a fistful of coins into a payphone and call home for a progress report from Kathy. I would stand outside the booth and listen to Jenny's end of the conversation. "He did? Seriously? Right into traffic? You weren't hurt, were you? Oh, thank God. I would have screamed too. What? Your shoes? Oh, no. And your purse? And he what? Wet cement, you say? What's the chance of that happening?" And so it would go. Each call was a litany of transgressions, one worse than the next, many of which surprised even us, hardened survivors of the puppy wars. When we arrived home, Marley raced outside to greet us. Kathy stood in the doorway, looking tired and strained. She had the faraway gaze of a shell-shocked soldier after a particularly unrelenting battle. Her bag was packed and sitting on the front porch, ready to go. She held her car key in her hand, as if she could not wait to escape. We gave her gifts and thanked her profusely. She excused herself politely and was gone. As best as we could figure, Kathy had been unable to exert any authority at all over Marley, and even less control. With each victory, he grew bolder. He forgot all about healing, dragging her behind him wherever he wished to go. He grabbed whatever suited him, shoes, purses, pillows, and would not let go. He stole food off her plate. He even tried taking over her bed. "Poor Kathy," Jenny said. "She looked kind of broken, don't you think?" "Shattered is more like it." "We probably shouldn't ask her to dog sit for us again." "No," I answered. "That probably wouldn't be a good idea." The next morning, Jenny and I both started back to work. But first, I slipped the choker chain around Marley's neck and took him for a walk. He immediately lunged forward, not even pretending to try to heal. "A little rusty, are we? Okay, let's try this again." "Marley, heal!" I ordered. By the end of the walk, my grip on the leash so tight that my knuckles had turned white, I finally managed to convince him I wasn't fooling around. If he wanted to lurch, I would choke him. If he wanted to cooperate and walk by my side, I would loosen my grip, and he would barely feel the chain around his neck. Lurch, choke, heel, breathe. It was simple enough for even Marley to grasp. As we turned into the driveway, my recalcitrant dog trotted along beside me, not perfectly, but respectably. For the first time in his life, he was actually healing, or at least attempting a close proximity of it. I would take it as a victory. "Oh, yes," I sang joyously, "the boss is back." Several days later, Jenny called me at the office. She had just been to see Dr. Sherman. "Luck of the Irish," she said. "Here we go again."